a qualified, educated person may not be up to the mark in culture, to recapitulate. The human individual encounters the world as an object of perception and activity. There is a kind of irreconcilability seen between the subjective side and the objective side. The world does not behave always as we would like it to behave, and we also do not behave in the manner in which the world is behaving. Nature and human society, which are the objective side of our experience, do not always seem to be going hand in hand with our whims and fancies. Our requirements, our needs, or our outlook of life. The world has its own way, as we have been seeing, and we do not feel competent enough to put ourselves in a state of harmony with the ways of the working of nature and human society. This is a kind of conflict that we have been noticing. When we started contemplating on the meaning of culture, we found it necessary to define the basic features of culture. Is a kind of refinement of personality. In this refined position that the personality assumes, the human individual to an extent rises above the limitations of his or her individuality, so that the conflict apparently seen between the individual and the world is diminished to a large extent. The more you are an individual by yourself, the more is the chance of your conflict with the world outside. Your assertion of your personality and individuality comes in conflict with the assertion of the world, which also maintains its own personality limitation. So either the world has to rise to the level of your way of thinking, or you have to rise to the level of the world's way of thinking. Somehow, it has been observed that we are not outside the world. We are part and parcel of nature as well as human society. Today I am only repeating briefly what I told yesterday, not something new. We are, on the one hand, physically part of nature, anatomically, physiologically. The same earth, water, fire, air, ether are constituting our physical body. We are inseparable from nature on the one hand, and on the other hand we are inseparable from human society also, because every person is a unit of human society. So whether you look at the whole circumstance from the point of view of nature or of human society, you cannot stand outside either of them. So it is incumbent on the part of an individual to bend below a little bit and burnish one's personality by scrubbing the ego a little bit and lessen the self-assertive instinct by which one rises above the limiting conditions of individuality. Limiting conditions of individuality are nothing but the ways of the working of the human ego. The status of culture is that heightened position which a person maintains above oneself. You have to rise above yourself in order that you may be regarded as a truly cultured person. Culture requires of you to be in a state of harmony with the conditions prevailing in life. A cultured person rarely comes in conflict with conditions prevailing in life. The malleable, flexible, harmonious, affectionate, very, very considerate behavior of a person which is the characteristic of true culture makes the person a super person, an individual, a super individual. Educated person differs from a cultured person almost in the same way as a politician differs from a statesman. We have politicians, but statesmen are very few. A statesman is a person with a wide vision of things, who looks into the future of the nation also, not merely into the present, and knows what is good for the nation for all time to come, not only for the present moment. But the politicians are thinking of the present moment only, and they have got a very narrow outlook of conditions prevailing today, and they do not bother about tomorrow. A statesman is a highly cultured person from the political point of view at least. In a similar manner, generally speaking, true culture raises the dimension of the very outlook of the person above the human individual personal viewpoint. That is to say, culture raises you to a level which is able to bring about the rapprochement or a reconciliation between yourself and the world. No more conflict between yourself and other people, and no more conflict between you and the world outside. A cultured person does not come in conflict with anything. He is a cementing factor, even where there is some conflict or disharmony. So these were some of the ideas that I tried to place before you yesterday as a brief statement of what culture is. Now we are expected to move in the direction of what our curriculum describes as India's ancient culture. We have to bear in mind every day what we heard yesterday, because whatever I will be telling you will be a continuation from what was told the previous day, and it will be difficult to go on repeating the same thing again and again. So please remember the brief outline of our discussion yesterday and the essentials of it, which I repeated today for your memory. I mentioned also that India has been considered as the repository of the most ancient of cultures. While there are cultures and cultures, every country has its own background of some culture. India, somehow or other, by freak of nature or by some circumstance, happened to the soil on which the earliest of cultures rose. What kind of culture rose? In the beginning, every person is like every other person. There is not much of a difference between among people from the point of view of the basic instincts or physical needs, etc. Hunger and thirst and need for security and the urge for survival are common features in all individuals. Primitive man, in the earliest of stages of the anthropological development of human nature, is said to have lived mostly under the pressure of the basic needs of the physical personality. If we are to go along the lines of the evolutionary process of nature, which seems to have risen gradually from mineral to plant, plant to animal, animal to man, etc., this way of thinking has been accepted both in the East and the West. There has been evolution. And in the process of evolution, the succeeding stage is supposed to overstep the limitations of the previous stage. It bypasses, it overcomes the conditions prevailing in the previous stage. And the succeeding stage is an improvement on the earlier one. For instance, human nature is an improvement on animal nature. But natural evolution has been seen to work in a peculiar way. That is to say, the succeeding stage has some little remnant left at the tail end, as it were, of the previous stage also, so that the earlier instincts are not completely destroyed or overcome in the succeeding stage. We sleep like a stone, we breathe like a plant, we have passions like an animal, and yet we are also human beings. Over and above these previous conditions characterizing the lower species, the earlier instincts are not completely overcome. A person becomes completely human only when the earlier instincts are subdued thoroughly. The animal, the plant, etc., have a localized consciousness of their person. The plant bothers only about itself, survival. The animal also is concerned only with itself. Each one for oneself and devil take the hindmost. This saying aptly fits into animal nature. If there are human beings also who think like this, I mind my business and you go to hell. If this kind of outlook also is seen in some human beings, we may conclude that even at the human level, sometimes there is the remnant of the earlier stages. Culture is buried deep as a potential in such stages of life, but it has not manifested itself even by a little modicum. When evolution progresses further, the animal man becomes a little bit more refined in the sense that he recognizes the necessity to live in a society. There is a tribal culture, for instance, primitive tribal culture, which is a way of living in groups of people with the common instincts and common needs. The totally independent animal life primitivity is found later to be unsuitable for even survival of oneself, because there is threat of nature's working on one side, there is threat of other individuals also existing side by side on the other side. So it became necessary in the process of gradual evolution to protect oneself from the onslaughts of nature. A habitat, a kind of house, was found to be essential, otherwise wind and rain and sun and cyclone will beat upon your head and nature may not allow you even to exist. A little bit of security from nature was found necessary, and security was necessary also from other people of the same kind. Because while one person recognizes the existence of another person as a human being, mostly under pressure of circumstances, a human being may not bother so much about the welfare of others when it comes to the question of one's own survival. Inasmuch as everyone has this instinct of survival of one's own self, and when you are cornered from all sides and pressed to an extreme, you may not mind somehow or other guarding yourself even at the cost of others. This is the animal working in man. Human society developed as a further stage in the course of history, where group culture arose, and the development superior to the purely individualistic and personal animal-like life, mutual cooperation was found to be a necessity for survival of everybody. I support you and you support me, and if you have any difficulty, I help you, and if I have any difficulty, you help me. What you lack, I give to you, and what I lack, you give to me. This is cooperation. Human society arose on account of the necessity felt by individuals to have a cooperative system for the sake of survival itself. Because no person is complete in himself. Everyone is terribly finite. Everyone lacks immensely something or the other. This lacuna, this lack, this need, this finitude is attempted to be made good by the cooperative spirit maintained by large number of people, and you have a community, and this community behaves in a particular way for the welfare of mutually, they behave in a particular way for their good. This is a primitive culture. Primitive culture in the sense it is the basic instinct of survival extending itself to the other people also in the community. The community culture requires that everybody should survive. Whereas in a purely individual state of affairs, it was like an animal roaming in the forest. The question of social culture does not arise. Now, there can be a group culture, a community culture like a tribal one, and yet it may not be up to the mark from the point of view of what you call human nature. We have to define human nature in a proper way. I think I mentioned it yesterday briefly. A human being is one who is in a position to recognize the same humanity in another person also. The great system which India's culture placed before us in this respect is in a Sanskrit passage. Atmanaha pratikulani paresham natamachare. You would not meet out to another what you would not like to be meted to yourself. That is to say, you would not behave in respect of another person in a manner which you would not like to be meted out to you by another. Culture starts from this recognition of it being imperative on the person to behave and conduct oneself in respect of others only as one would expect others to behave in one way. If you are hungry, you must know others also can be hungry. If you are thirsty, you must know that others also can equally be thirsty. If you are exhausted, you must know that others also can be exhausted. If you want to live long, you must know that others also would like to live long. And if you don't want to die, others also will not like to die. If that is the case, how would you behave with others? You will adjust yourself in society in such a manner that you will give the same concession to other people, same freedom, as you are trying to give to your own self. Do you know how much freedom you want? Are you not exercising freedom? A lot of concession is given by each one to one's own self. You would be very niggardly and miserly in giving concession to other people. You will be very strict on others, but very liberal when one's own self. To that extent you are liberal to yourself, to that extent you must be liberal to others also. And if you find there is a limitation necessary to put on personality, it will be equally applicable to others also. It doesn't mean that you can control others and you don't want to control. There are limitations on others only and for you no limitations. Culture, as a human requirement, rises to the status of a freedom that is granted equally to all people. And culture becomes a harmonizing principle operating among a group of people. That group may be a little community, or it may be a country which you call a nation. You have got a national culture. Indian nation has an Indian culture. European nation, European culture, etc., etc. The difference in cultures of nationalities arises on account of various factors such as geographical location, hereditary tradition, and the needs of people under the conditions they are placed. These are some of the factors among many others that define the difference among cultures. Now, having taken note of the roots of human culture being connected with human needs, we have also to go a little deep into what these needs are. Cultures arise on account of the needs of people. The basic needs, of course, are very clear, as I mentioned, hunger and thirst, and security. You have to eat in order that you may live. And also you have to be protected from any kind of onslaught from outside. Towards this end, cultures move. But this is not a refined form of culture, because this definition of culture limiting itself to bodily needs, physical survival, does not take into consideration other needs of people, such as mind, feeling, understanding, and spirit. You may be happy even when you are granted the freedom to physically live comfortably with all security that is required, but physical comfort and security does not touch the whole of human nature, because we have other needs like self-respect, as I mentioned yesterday, which is not a physical necessity. You require to be recognized. The asking for recognition is not a physical need. It is a need from the mental state of the person. The mind has a hunger, as the body also has a hunger. The mind asks for a peculiar diet of its own, as the physical body also asks for it. It aspires. The body has a need, but the mind has an aspiration. It longs for certain things in a realm which is not necessarily physical. So culture becomes more and more refined when it becomes more and more psychological and rational. Tribal culture confines itself to purely physical needs. But higher culture takes into consideration the needs of the psyche, because human aspiration, human longing, when it rises to a certain stage in evolution, begins to dream of possibilities, expectations, realizations, etc., beyond merely the physical level. These people are the philosophers. This also I am repeating. Yesterday I touched this subject. A philosopher is a dreamer of the higher realms of experience, rising above the limitations of the subject and the object, visualizing some vast domain of attainment and achievement, which rises above the circumscribed location of the perceiving subject and the world outside. The world which is physical and social is also limited to that particular aspect only, and human individual perceiver of the world is limited in a different way. There is a possibility of rising above both these conditioning factors, subjective and objective. The mind dreams of universal possibility. It hopes to achieve a condition of living which may rise not only above the subjective and objective sides of ordinary living, but may positively achieve a super physical and super individual reality above this world of physical and individual nature. In India, culture is supposed to have started from the time of the Vedas, you must have heard that there is a group of scriptures called the Vedas. Vedas, these are the scriptures of the fundamental religion of India, consists of records left by persons who dreamt of realms above the earth, visualized possibilities of experience and attainment far above the limitations of the human person. Philosophically, the need to look above, I am repeating again what I said yesterday, we look within and look without and look above. I said there are three ways of looking at things. We look within into our own selves as individuals, we look without at the world of society and nature, but we also look above into the starry heavens and wonder at the firmament of far-reaching potentialities and profundities. We would like to touch the stars and rise above the conditions of the world and of our own physical personality. We say there are two great wonders in the world, the starry heavens above and the moral law within. These are the great wonders. You cannot understand what the starry heavens are. They remain a mystery for us. What exactly it is that you are gazing at in a clear night sky? What are these that are twinkling before you? How are they hung up in mid sky? how do they exist at all in that manner? That is a wonderful. The other wonder is our own conscience saying that you must do the right thing. You may not know what it is that is right. It may not be easy for you to know what exactly is the right thing. But you know very well that it is necessary to do the right thing. The conscience will not tell you that wrong things will be done. Whether or not you know what is right and wrong, you at least know that it is good to be right. The mystery behind the very consciousness of it being necessary to be righteous, and the mystery of the heavens are supposed to be the greatest mystery, is the contemplation on these mysteries makes one a philosopher above the psychologist, the physicist or the sociologist. The physicist studies physical nature, the components of matter. The sociologist studies human behavior in society. The psychologist studies the functions of the mind. But why do they function in that manner? Why should physical matter behave in the manner it behaves? Why do people in society conduct themselves in a manner in which they behave? And why are you thinking in the manner you think? There is a way in which you think. All people think in some but fundamental manner. But why should you think in that manner? Can there not be any other way of thinking? Why? This question is the subject of philosophical study. How? This is supposed to be the function of science. Science studies the how of things, and philosophy goes into the why of things. Science cannot tell you why the electrons move in that particular manner around the nucleus. They tell you how they do, but why should they behave in that manner? They direct in a system which is of their own. And why should people behave in the manner they behave? Why should people ask for things which they are asking for? Psychology and physics have their own limitations. Psychology is limited to subjective phenomena. Physics is limited to objective phenomena. Philosophy is supposed to be a science and art which will endeavor to lift you up above the limitations of both psychology and physics, as well as sociology. The way the Samhita consists of records of these solvers of yore who lived in India several centuries back, and in the Samhita, Samhita means a collection of hymns, H-Y-M-N-S. Basically they are prayers offered to God in the heaven. Any kind of prayer is a hymn. The Vedas are classified into certain books known as Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda. These are the earliest records of human history available. All history came after. Nobody wrote history before the Rig Veda. The earliest history of mankind you find in the Rig Veda Samhita, the great collection of hymns and prayers, written in ecstatic metrical poetry. These great masters seem to have been great poets also. They are not just scribbling down whatever they thought in a slipshod manner. It is a wonder that such mystical poems could be composed by those ancients who are supposed to have lived in this country some thousands of years back. The meter of the Samhitas is a wonder. You know what is a meter? It is a set formula according to which words are arranged in rhythm and in the arrangement of words in a given manner. This Rigveda Samhita particularly is a great wonder. So English and historians, even the number of the letters of the Samhita has been counted. About 10,000 hymns are there in the Rigveda Samhita, and the total number of words in the whole book is counted, and that number has not varied till today, right from the ancient times of its origin. Those days there was no writing on paper. Knowledge was communicated from mouth of the guru to ear of the disciples. The whole Veda was committed to memory. For centuries, the Veda Samhita was preserved through memory only, and not by printed books or written scripts. You can imagine such a huge tome being kept in memory for centuries. Even today in India we have some masters. Their number is diminishing gradually to almost extinction. Especially in southern India we have got some pandits who can recite the entire Veda by heart. There may be half a dozen, but still they are. Anyway, Rigveda Samhita is a great wonder. As a scripture, it is a wonder. As a book of prayer, it is a wonder. As a poem, it is a wonder. And as a mystical guide to understand life as a whole, also it is a wonder. The Vedas were supposed to have been edited by a great master called Vedavyasa. Krishna Dvaipayana Vedavyasa. It appears, students one day went to a great master and said, please teach us Vedas. And the answer was, Ananda Veda, infinite is the Veda. It was not easy to explain the meaning of the Veda because its profundity was infinite. Experience, whatever the experience is, has many phases or facets. An experience can be purely subjective from your own point of view, and experience can be purely objective from the point of view of the world outside. An experience can be supernatural from the point of view of
A connection link that is there between the subject and the object. The connecting link person arises because of the fact that you cannot know the world at all unless there is a medium of connection between you and the world. You are aware that the world is there because there is some link connecting you with the world. The world has not entered your eyes. The mountain, for instance, is far away. The knowledge of the fact that there is a mountain in front of you arises not because the mountain has entered your eyes, not also because you have gone and hit your head against the mountain. It arises because there is an invisible link between you and the world of. It is invisible. The whole point is that if this invisibility had not been there, if the link between you and the object were visible, there would have been a tremendous transformation of your personality. You would not have been a human being also. Fortunately or unfortunately, this link has been kept a secret by the Creator of the world, and no one knows what is there between you and me. If this is known, neither I will be what I am, nor you will be what you are. Anyway, this is a different subject. So, experience becomes subjective. It can be objective. It can be something beyond the subject and the object we call transcendental. So the Vedas can be studied from various points of view, as an adhyatma vidya or the subjective science of spirit, as a bhautika vidya or an objective science of the world, as a divya or a advaita vidya or a science of the God superintending over the whole of creation, or karma vidya, or the action that we perform in this world. It also deals with the way in which you have to live in this world by performing action. So, adhyajna is the name that is given to this aspect of Veda. The adhyatma is the science of the inner spirit. The adhibhuta is the science of the objective world. The adhidaiva is the science of the gods in heaven. The adhyajna is the science of action in the world. And adhidharma is another thing, the manner in which you can righteously living it. These are Sanskrit words. It is better you note down. Adhyatma, which is the science of the subjective spirit. Adhibhuta, the science of the objective universe. Adhidaiva, the science of the celestials in heaven, God. Adhiyajna, the science of action in the world, performance of action. Adhidharma, the science of righteousness. Vedas, therefore, are difficult to understand. They cannot be English translated also, because most of the English translations or Hindi translations, whatever it is, are translations from one point of view only. Purely the linguistic and grammatical meanings are given, but the profundity is